We're ready for Matthew chapters 14 and 15 in our study this morning. This is our summary of the ministries of Jesus. And as we plug Matthew into that, we are in the Galilean ministry where we will be to the 18th chapter. Remind you of that each time to kind of tell you where we are. Here is our outline that we're following from Baxter of the book of Matthew. We're in that Galilean ministry. We've talked about what he taught and then what he wrought, and we'll see more of the miracles in our study today. And this section, 11 to 18, though it's not the only thing there, but as Baxter outlines that, this is what the people thought, the reaction. We'll focus on that a little bit later as we go into our study a little further. Just as a reminder, we have some ground to cover, but this is a survey. We have more and more people joining us through YouTube all the time. And so for those who are just joining us recently in our studies, this is a survey. And so we're going at a pretty good pace. We're going to look at chapters 14 and 15, and that explains kind of the pace at which we're going. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1 of Matthew is about what? Yeah, genealogy and the birth of Jesus. Chapter 2? Yeah, wise men and the massacre of the children. Chapter 3 was John the Baptist and the baptism of Jesus. Chapter 4, temptation. What we hope to accomplish here is, with each book of the Bible that we go through, you won't remember every chapter of every Bible, of every book. But hopefully that in the future, if you're not real familiar with Matthew, that when somebody quotes from Matthew 4, oh, that's the temptation passage. Chapter 3, oh, that's where Jesus was baptized, or talks about John the Baptist. Or chapter 2, that's the massacre of the children. That you think in turns before you even get turned there what those chapters are about. Now, chapters 5 through 7 deal with the Sermon on the Mount. Chapters 8 and 9 we group together dealing with miracles and discipleship. Chapter 10 is where he chose his apostles, the limited commission, very good. Chapter 11, John sends messengers and the invitation. Chapter 12, Pharisees find fault as they often and always do. And then chapter 13 ought to be an immediate reminder, this is where the parables are mentioned. That's not the only place parables are found, but that's predominantly parables in chapter 13. All right, here's chapter 14 now. In chapter 14, if you don't have an answer to question number one, I'll give the answer in the interest of time, that chapter 14 is about John being beheaded and more miracles that he performed. There seems to be partly the emphasis, to get ahead of ourselves to the miracle section, an emphasis on the nature of miracles here, and we'll say more about that a little bit later. Let's talk about John being beheaded now, and we will only call attention to any parallel accounts as it enhances our understanding of the particular text. There is a parallel account of this in Mark chapter 6, briefly in Luke 9, not much found in Luke, But we'll talk about Luke 9 here in just a second. Let's talk about Herod. At the time, Herod the Tetrarch, that is, he was a ruler, is the idea of him being of a territory, is the idea of him being a Tetrarch. So what Herod are we talking about? When you read in the New Testament about a king named Herod, it's not always talking about the same one. This is the family of Herod. This is one of the better family trees. And this gets a little confusing, but let's start right here with Herod the Great. That's not who we're talking about. And here is his wives, and he had a son named, right here, he has a son named Herod Antipas. That's our Herod in this text. You might make a marginal note, this is Herod Antipas. Now, there's some other key players here in the context. There is Herodias. Herodias had been married to Antipas's brother, Philip, who's also a son of Herod the Great. And so here's Philip, who's not mentioned here, but he was married to Herodias. Antipas persuaded her to divorce him and come and be married to him, and thus the marriage, it's unscriptural. Make sense? All right, now she and Philip had a daughter named Salome. She's also in the picture, though not named. So you might want to make a marginal note about verse verse 6 that this is talking about Siloam. Those are the key players in the context. Now, when it says he was the tetrarch, he was the ruler of these regions. You see, as you know, I have trouble with colors, but whatever color, this region and Perea, Galilee and Perea, there were others that were ruling over this region of Judea and Samaria, but over Galilee and Perea is where he ruled. Now, this city here is where it is thought that John was beheaded, for what that may be worth to us. But anyway, let's get underway of chapter 14, 1 to 4. That when he heard this report about Jesus, he hears the report of the miracles, and Luke 9 and verse 9 says, this account doesn't tell us, he wanted to go see him. Herod wants to go see the one about whom the report is made. But he doesn't think about it being Jesus. He thinks this may be John. Now that's quite interesting to me. Why did he think this was John the Baptist if he had had him killed? Because yeah, he thought he was raised from the dead, but he had such degree of respect, we'll get to a little bit later, for John and for John's teaching, that he thought something must be true about John and his teaching. This must be a man of God that God's raised from the dead. This could be John the Baptist that's been raised from the dead. And therefore the powers are at work through him. He wanted to go see him, again, Luke 9, and see what this was all about. Now we have the backstory to that. John, let's drop down to verse 3 and then we'll finish verse 4. For he had laid hold of John and bound him and put him in prison for Herodias' sake, his brother Philip's wife, that we've already described. And here's the reason, because he had said, it's not lawful for you to have her. So this was an unlawful marriage. There's a lot to learn about divorce and remarriage from that, though we're not going to go there. So in verses 1 to 4, he had laid hold on him, put him in prison, and John had said, your marriage is unlawful. It's not lawful for you to be married to her. Now, let's start at verse 5. And what happens in verses 5 to 12? All right, they had John beheaded. And although he had wanted to put him to death, he feared the multitude. There was in some way he wanted to do that too. But he was fearful of the multitude that may turn on him because they viewed John as a prophet. So notice, I'm already beginning to see Herod is a man of weakness. He's a man of power. He has authority. What weakness do you see? We see several weaknesses here. Yeah. If this is the right thing to do to put him to death, do it and don't worry about what the crowd thinks. But he's worried about the crowd. They're going to turn on me. He's worried about popularity. He's a politician. And so when he had a birthday, Herodias' daughter came, that's Salome that we've mentioned, and she danced before him, and she pleased him, and he gave an oath that whatever she wanted, he would give. And so she went and asked her mother, and there was this conniving together, and she said, ask for John the Baptist. I want you to pay attention to verse 9. And the king was sorry. I have a sermon I built on that phrase, and the king was sorry. Quite often we make decisions, we take actions that later we regret and realize we did the wrong thing. He had made a vow, whatever you want, I'll give you. And she said, I want the head of John the Baptist. And it's, oops, I should not have given that vow. But notice further at verse 9, because of the oaths, plural, there were repeated oaths. He repeatedly said, whatever you want, whatever you want. Whatever you desire, whatever you want me to do, I'll do it for you. And when she asked for the head of John the Baptist, he decided he had to do that for her. All right, so then, in interest of time, verse 12 said the disciples came and took his body away, etc. Make sense? Now, I want to talk just a moment about a contrast between John and Herod. John is seen here as a man of strength who stands up to a king who can have his head taken off and tell him he's wrong. That's truth to power, as we call it in politics. That's truth to power. You tell a man to his face who can take your head off, you're wrong. You've sinned. On the other hand, Herod is a weak man who caves to the people and caves to the pressure. John was good to Herod. Herod was evil to John. John was ruled by reason. Herod was ruled by passion. In other words, he in a drunken state said, whatever you want, I'll give it to you. John resisted pressure. Herod gave in to pressure. What a contrast. You would think if you just walked on the scene and said, here's King Herod, and here is this John the Baptist who eats locusts and wild honey, and look the way he dresses, I know which one's the weak character and which one's the strong. And it was just the opposite of that. Make sense? Now, I want to go back just for a moment and tie Mark 6 with this. Let's go back to about verse 5, that he wanted to put him to death, but he feared the people. Let's go to Mark 6, parallel account for this, and look at verses 19 and 20. Herodias held it against him and wanted to kill him, for Herod feared John, knowing he was a just and a holy man, and he protected him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. So Herod only wanted to put him to death because Herodias did. That's the point. But he really respected John in some way. Do you see that point? He had listened to John and had made changes in his life and liked to listen to John's teaching and preaching. He liked to hear, and he didn't like what he said about his marriage apparently, but he did like to hear him. And he had respect for him and respected him as a just and a holy man and one that indeed came from God. Make sense? All right, let's move on. Let's, question number 4, if you don't have that, what kind of relationship did they have together? I was focusing on the parallel account to that, Mark 6, 19 and 20 for your answer if you don't have that. All right. Now let's talk about the miracles of Jesus being grouped together again, beginning at verse 13. Now let's get some insight to some parallel accounts. By the way, if you're keeping up with dates, and some of you are, and I've tried to give some of those, at verse 1, that's about 28 A.D. Again, we talk about chronologies all the time. That may vary from somebody else's chronology by a year or so. But at verse 13, we're looking at about early 29 A.D. So when Jesus heard about this, he departed and went to a place by himself. And so where did he go? Well, a couple of things about that. One is he went to Bethsaida of Julius. Now, there's two Bethsaidas, so let's talk about that on a map for what it may be worth to us. There is a Bethsaida mentioned here, and then there is a Bethsaida over here in Galilee. This is the Bethsaida we're talking about, Bethsaida of Julius. And that harmonizes with the parallel accounts for what that may be worth to us. But Luke tells us that. Luke 9 and verse 10. So you say, where'd you get that information? I'm looking through and I don't see Bethsaida. You find that in Luke's account in Luke 9, 10 for what that may be worth to us. Now, this is the only miracle that we have right here. This is the only miracle of the feeding of the 5,000 that's recorded by all four accounts, by all four Gospels, that is. All of them mention that. So anyway, let's see what happens here. A multitude followed Jesus. Verse 14 says he was moved with compassion and he healed them. Now what Mark's account and Luke's account both suggest, Mark 6, 34 and Luke 9, 11, if I remember correctly. Yeah, that's right. Mark 6, 34, 9, 11 of Luke. Jesus taught him. Not taught, mentioned here, but Jesus did some teaching to this crowd. Not only did he work the miracles, but he's teaching them in the concept and the context. Now then, what happens at verse 15? Send them away to the villages that they may buy food. And Jesus said, no need to send them away. You give them something to eat. Now that's a challenge to the disciples. What are we going to give them? And they said, we only have 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Now, this account doesn't tell us, but John 6 said they got those 5 loaves and 2 fishes from a lad, yes. John 6 and in verse 9. And so he said, bring them to me. And then he had them to sit down on the grass. Mark says in Mark 6, 39 and 40, he had them to divide into groups. Now, what was the significance of that? I don't know. Perhaps, this is conjecture, and a lot of conjecture here, by dividing them in groups, you can see the number of people, that it's obvious that maybe you've got 100 or maybe it's 500 in this group, or whatever the case may be. Does that make sense? That may have been the case, but that's conjecture and that's only mine. And when he got through feeding them all, what was the reaction? What was the result? They took up 12 basketful of fragments, far more fragments than they had to start with. Obviously, a miracle has been performed. But they fed 5,000 men besides women and children. So we talk about the feeding of the 5,000. The Jews counted the men. That doesn't mean the women weren't important, but that's how they numbered. Whether you like that or not, that's just the way it was. And so that's not counting the women and children. So it was likely that there were 10,000 or more that could have been fed. So if you had at least a woman or a child per man, that's 10,000. That's a lot of people. So we talk about the feeding of the 5,000, far more than that. But let's be a little more conservative and said there wasn't that much. There was only half as many of the women and children as there were men. So that's 7,500 that were fed. That's a lot of people that were fed. Doesn't matter. It could have been 10 million and he could have fed the same. Now what I'm interested in is two things before we leave that. Let's look at John 6 and in verse 14, a parallel account. John 6 and 14. And those men who had seen the sign that Jesus did said, truly the prophet, this is truly the prophet who has come into the world. Perhaps thinking of what was said to Moses, that, or what Moses had said, that God would raise up a prophet like in him. Truly, this is the prophet that's come into the world. We've been waiting for this prophet. This is him. That was the reaction. Does that make sense? Matthew didn't tell us that. John does. All right, now let's talk about the nature of the miracles. All of the miracles recorded here, most of them, listen, let me just word it that way. Most of the miracles focus on Jesus' power over nature. There are times there's power over disease, but he has power over nature because he can take food and make that food feed thousands, perhaps 10,000 people here. But let's just use the number of the men, feed 5,000 and still have more left over. He has power over nature. Does that make sense? All right, we're going to see the same thing at the water here in just a moment. Questions or comments on the feeding of the 5,000? All right. Let's go now to verses 22 to 23, and Jesus walks on the water here. So let's see what happens in this. That Jesus put his disciples in a boat before him to go to the other side. All right? Now that's a little bit of a question here. We think that where he was over here at Bethsaida of Julius. And so to go to the other side, the parallel accounts said he went to Bethsaida. I thought he was leaving Bethsaida. He was. But he's going to the other Bethsaida. Does that make sense? And of Galilee. But John's account, that's Mark's account, John's account said he was going to Capernaum. So what we take it is that he was going to the other side. He's going from over here to over in this region. So somewhere across the northern part of the sea is where he's going. Now John's account says that the events of Jesus walking on water was about 3 or 4 miles out into the sea. Matthew doesn't tell us that. Matthew tells us this was in the fourth watch of the night. That would be between 3 and 6 a.m. So in the early hours of the morning is when this takes place. And so let's get the point. Jesus went, while they're out on the boat, he went by himself to the mountain to pray. There's a practical thing to learn there. He often went in solitude, Mark 1, Luke 6. You know the parallel accounts. Pay attention at verse 24. What's going on as they're out in the boat in the midst of the sea? A storm begins to rise, and so the winds begin to toss. And now notice verse 26, that Jesus comes walking to them on water. There are three miracles I want you to see in this context. I don't mean the context. I'm talking about in the story of the walking on water. The first is, here again, is power over nature. He's walking on the water. That's a miracle. So he's walking on water, which means there's power over nature. We'll list all three of them here in a second. But at verse 26, they thought they'd seen a ghost, and they cried out in fear. Now take a quick look at Mark 6 for what it's worth. Let's go quickly to Mark 6 And what is it, verse 52? Mark's account says they were fearful for they had not understood about the loaves. In other words, they had seen the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. That should have made them conclude, look at the power he has over nature. And as we see someone walking on water, that must be our Lord because he has power over nature. They didn't conclude that though. Does that make sense? They should have, but they didn't. Mark seems to imply that in Mark 6:52. All right. So he says, it's not I, be not afraid. All right, one miracle, he walks on water. Second miracle, Peter said, if it's you, command me to come to you on water. And so he said to him, come, and Peter came down and walks on water. Second miracle, defying gravity, power over nature. So he makes Peter walk on water. Not only can he walk, he can make somebody else walk on water. But that's not all. Here's a third. I said there were three. There's actually four. I'm going to get ahead of myself. I'm going to come back to what we're skipping. But look at verse 31. When Peter cries out for help, he reaches out his hand and saves him. That's also a miracle. I take it. You may want to discount that one. If so, then you go to the number three. I'm going to number four. The fourth miracle is at verse 32. When they got in the boat, what happened to the storm? Ceased. Second time that's happened, Mark 8, Matthew 8 was the other account. Make sense? So right here in this one context, here's four accounts of his power over nature. He walks on water, can make someone else walk on water, can save someone who is sinking just by reaching out his hand. I don't think that's a description of his power and his strength, but even if it is, he's standing on water while saving someone else and then causes the wind to stop. Look at verse 30. I'm going to do a sermon here for long on this, so I'm not going to spend much time. I don't want to steal my own thunder. But look at verse 30. That when Peter, he was walking, and what caused him to sink? Took his eye off the Lord and began to focus on the dangers around him and looked at the boisterous wind. And he began to sink and cried, Lord, save me. And he was rebuked, O you of little faith. Why did he rebuke him? I'd be scared too of a storm, wouldn't you? All right, Christ was with him. The feeding of the 5,000. Jesus can walk on water. If he can walk on water and make me walk on water, then I've got nothing to be afraid of. But before we get too rough on the disciples, and we need to be too, that we also have those same problems that Peter had. All right, now notice the reaction, because that's what we're interested in here. Verse 33, the reaction was, this is truly, you are Son of God. If you can do this, stop the wind, make a man walk, you walk yourself on water, you are truly the Son of God. All right, let's quickly go to the healing of the multitude, 29 to 31. I meant to go backwards with my slide instead of going forward. That's not where I want to go. Let's talk about the healing of many in 34 to 36. That's where we are. Now we're together. When they crossed over to the land of Gennesaret. Now, all right, try to keep up with our map where we are. Gennesaret is not, but it's right here in this region, about where my little arrow is. And so when they finally came over there after the storm is over, and they came to a place that they recognized, and all that were surrounding him, they brought all those who were sick. But here's the interesting miracle, verse 36. What's different about the miracles now? He's not laying his hands on them. They're coming just touching his garment. And so again, he has power over disease, but also power over nature. So I think the emphasis that Matthew is painting here is the power that he has. Not just that he can work miracles, but he has power over disease. He has power over nature, seems to be the emphasis that he's making. Makes sense? All right. Now, let's go further. Let's go to chapter 15, see if we can make sense of chapter 15. This is eating with unwashed hands and miracles again. So let's talk about the eating with the unwashed hands. It's not where I meant to go. And let's talk about the Pharisees' charge. They said concerning Jesus that your disciples transgress tradition of the... why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread. That's in verses 1 and 2. All right. The tradition of the elders, the Talmud, consisted of two things. One was the Mishnah, which was a record of their traditions that they lived by. And then there was the commentary that went with that, and the two things together made up the Talmud. And that occupied, or that was what consisted of their traditions that they followed. Now, Mark's account of this, Mark 7, you might turn over to Mark 7 just for a moment and look at verses 3 and 4, the parallel account, that this was not hygiene. This was not, why do your disciples not use hygiene and why are they eating with contaminated hands? This was a religious ritual, because Mark 7 says that they would hold their hands in a special way. And so there were certain ways in which after they washed they were to hold their hands. Some talk about there was a double pouring of the water up to the wrist. So it wasn't just a matter of here's some water and let me wash my hands, I'm ready to eat. Oh, no, you didn't wash your hands. You didn't go through the ritual of holding your hands in the right way and doing the double portion of washing, etc. There was a special ceremony. And so this was a religious ritual they went through. So why do your disciples not do that when they eat? And so Jesus gave two responses to that. Let's see what they are. What's the first? Yeah, he's exactly. You're taking the commandments of God and replacing them with your traditions, the commandments of men. So let's get ahead of ourselves to verse 9, the end of that section. In vain they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. You might underline that. That's equal to the tradition. Jesus is talking about tradition, and he's calling it the commandments of men. Now, how did they do that? Well, he said, here's an example of doing that. Here's a command to honor your father and mother. But what y'all have figured out is a way to set that aside by saying what I would have done to take care of my parents, what I would have done to take care of them in their old age, I gave to the temple. I'm exempt from that. And he said, you're taking your traditions and doing away with the will of God. So why? You ask me, why do we violate the tradition of the elders? I'm asking you, why do you violate the commandments of God by your traditions? That makes sense? And he calls them hypocrites, verse 7, and said the fulfillment of prophecy of Isaiah, where Isaiah says, they honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. You're teaching the commandments of men. His second response was what? All right, very good. Let's clarify something. Jesus is not saying what goes in the mouth doesn't physically defile a man. What Jesus is focusing on, you might make a marginal note, he's talking about spiritual defilement. Does that make sense? Because that which you take into your mouth can defile you, can it not? Drink poison, will it defile you? Oh yeah, it'll kill you. That's not what he's talking about. He is not saying then, as some have argued, Jesus says it's okay to deliberately destroy your body with drugs. He's not saying that at all. What he's saying is the concern should not be what goes into the mouth and is eliminated from the body, but what comes forth from the mind, that's what spiritually defiles a man. Does that make sense? That's his point. So let's get that point quickly and then we'll get to the rest of the chapter. So notice... when Jesus said that, you might flag verse 12. The disciples came to him and said, did you know the Pharisees were offended? That caused me to pause a little bit. And I thought, did I miss? I've seen that before, but I'd forgot I'd seen that. And I go back and read that again and I check some others to see, did they catch what I think I caught? Cal Pope in his work says that what goes on at verse 12 is the disciples here are sympathetic to the Pharisees. And that's what I was thinking. Didn't mean they approved of the Pharisees, but quite often as you preach on some sin and somebody got upset about that and somebody will be sure to come and tell you, I think you made them mad. And they're sympathetic to that. And Jesus wasn't too sympathetic for the Pharisees. How do I know? Absolutely. In other words, I take verse 13 and forward, not only a rebuke of the Pharisees, but it seems to be a rebuke of that attitude of the disciples. For he said, and let me paraphrase verse 13, do you not know? Do you not understand that if it's something that God hadn't planned, that God's going to root it up? Don't be sympathetic to the Pharisees. Let them alone. They're blind leaders of the blind. They're false teachers. They're leading people astray. Don't worry about them being offended. Think about what the damage that they're doing. And so Peter said, explain this all to us. And he said, okay. Verse 17. That which enters into the mouth doesn't contaminate you spiritually. That's eliminated from the body. But he said, here's what I'm concerned about. That which comes forth from the mind or the heart, like evil thoughts and murders and adulteries, fornication and false witnesses, that defiles a man, not eating with unwashed hands. Does that make sense? Because the Pharisees thought eating with unwashed hands defiled you physically, but it also defiled you spiritually. They're sinning. They're done wrong because... No. What goes into the body doesn't defile you spiritually. It's what comes out of the mind. That's what you focus on. Does that make sense? Two rebukes of that. All right, we shift to miracles again. So let's look at the miracles beginning at verse 21. Here is the healing of the Gentile's daughter. This is the Syrophoenician woman that's mentioned in Mark 7. She is a Greek. Now, what's interesting about this is if you want to make there's two things about the miracle. One is we see the power over demons and power over the spiritual realm, over the spiritual world. I also see power over distance. And Mark's account's going to give us evidence of that. We don't know from Matthew whether this demon-possessed daughter is with her or not. It doesn't sound like she is, but Mark says she wasn't. Mark says she's back at home. And when they get back at home, find out she's been healed. But let's go back to verse 23. When she cried out to Jesus, what was his reaction? This is a surprise, big surprise to me. He didn't say nothing. Are you kidding me? I thought this was the kind of person Jesus was looking for. And he ignores her. That may be a test of the disciples, may be a test of her. It seems to be calling forth for faith from her. And so she keeps crying out. And he said, I've only been sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And she said, I know, and I'm paraphrasing, but I'll take the bread of the crumbs that fall on the floor. I'll take anything from you. And then Jesus responds saying, you're a woman of great faith. Notice at verse 28, O woman, great is your faith. Let it be done as you desire. And her daughter was healed that very hour. Now, Mark's account says she wasn't even there. The daughter wasn't even there. So if you want to take a look, I'm not going to turn there. Mark 7:29 and 30. When she got back home, the daughter's healed. So there's power over demons, over the spiritual realm, but power over distance. And so that's amazing miracles. And if I could just put my hand, no, you don't have to be there to put your hands on. Just say it, it's done. Look at the power he has. All right, let's keep moving. Let's talk about the healing of the multitude and what we have in the multitude here is Jesus skirted the Sea of Galilee. All that means is he walked along the shore. That's all it means. And some of your translations, in fact, I think the English Standard may do that, I'm not sure, but some of your translations said he walked along the shore. So he skirted the Sea of Galilee, and he came and he found those that were lame and blind and mute and maimed and many others. Turn over quickly to Mark 7. Starting at verse 31, and you have a little more information there of what happened. that he took a man and he put his fingers in his ears and he spat and touched his tongue and he looked up to heaven and said, Ephatha, which means be opened. That happened on this occasion, but Matthew doesn't tell us, but Mark does. I'm just giving you a little additional information. The reaction at verse 31, back in Matthew, we're back in Matthew now. The reaction was, they glorified God. So there is some negative reaction, like the Pharisees. There is some positive reaction. So we're getting mixed reaction to the miracles of Jesus. Now let's finish up by looking at the feeding of the 4,000. Not the same event. This time we have 4,000. And so you might make a marginal note. We've been talking about power over. Here again is power over nature. Power over nature, power over substance. So here we again, you would think from the previous miracles, if there's people that need to be fed, the disciples would say, I know what you're going to do. You're going to feed like you did the 5,000. Nope. His disciples said to him, where could we get enough bread in the wilderness to fill such a great multitude? Now this again is 4,000 men, so that could be as many as, six to 8,000, maybe more. Because we're not counting the women and children. So what did they have to do with? Verse 34. How many loaves? Seven loaves, and how many fish? A few. We don't know how many. But it's not enough to feed 4,000 or 8,000 people. And so he gave to the multitude, and everybody was filled. And how many fragments did they take up? Yeah, seven baskets full of fragments. And those that ate were 4,000 men besides women and children. All right. Now then, we're going to end, and our time is gone, that verse 39, he sent the multitude away and got in a boat and came to Magdala. And so where is that? Well, what I didn't tell you, which you should have taken note of, back at verse 21, Matthew 15, when he came and healed the Syrophoenician woman, that was up here in this region of Tyre and Sidon. So Jesus made his way up here, as this arrow indicates, but now he's made his way back down to Magdala, which is on that western side of the Sea of Galilee. That's where we're going to leave him, because we're done. Matthew 15, chapter 16 and 17, next time.